40584, U.S. versus Lopez.
As always, huh?
As always. May it please the court, good morning. This case is an attempted illegal reentry case in which Mr. Lopez proceeded pro se in a trial before the district judge. And we've raised four issues on appeal, but the government has essentially conceded on the fourth, which deals with the need for correction of the written judgment. So today I will address only the first three, if I'm able to. I'd like to start first with Mr. Lopez's purported waiver of counsel, the first issue on appeal, because I think that presents the most fundamental error in this case. The default position in our justice system is that people who are accused of crimes will be represented by counsel as guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment. Nevertheless, the Supreme Court recognized in Ferretta versus California that defendants also have a constitutional right to waive counsel and to represent themselves. However, the court in Ferretta cautioned that courts should permit pro se representation only where they are truly satisfied that the defendant is knowingly and intelligently waiving the right to counsel. And that's the problem here, that the record does not disclose that Mr. Lopez was knowingly and intelligently waiving his right to counsel. Now, Ferretta sets out a number of things that the judge should inquire into or warn the defendant about, and one of the most important components of the warnings prescribed by Ferretta is that defendant should be warned about the dangers and disadvantages of self-representation. For example, defendants should be told that they're going to have to comply with all the rules of procedure and evidence, just the same as a lawyer, and that the court is not going to give them any special assistance in trying their case.
Well, I don't think Ferretta sets up a real test. In other words, it's not like a Rule 11 checklist, but it's more of a, you know, aren't we bound by a finding, factual finding that he's competent to stand trial and that he knew what he was doing? I mean, don't we have to defer to the trial court in some measure on this?
No, not at all, Your Honor. As we pointed out in the brief, this court's review of whether there's a knowing and intelligent waiver is de novo. And even competent defendants have to be warned about the dangers and disadvantages of proceeding pro se. And the fact that Mr. Lopez was at best marginally competent just makes it worse in this case.
How many convictions in his background?
Well,
he was no stranger to the justice system.
Well, that is true, but as the Ninth Circuit said in the Ballew case, the mere fact that a defendant has been repeatedly exposed to the legal process and has even represented himself before cannot, without more, suffice to support a finding of a knowing and intelligent waiver. And here, it's even more attenuated because, yes, Mr. Lopez had a very lengthy criminal history, but if you go back and look, I see only one conviction that specifically states that Mr. Lopez proceeded pro se. In others, he was represented by counsel. Others, it doesn't specify. But there is no evidence in any of those convictions that he ever proceeded pro se or with counsel to a jury trial or a bench trial of any type. And that is a critical difference in this case because, as the Supreme Court said in Iowa versus Tovar, when you're talking about going pro se at a trial as opposed to a guilty plea proceeding or a sentencing proceeding, the pitfalls of self-representation must be, quote, unquote, rigorously conveyed. So there is a difference that the court recognized in Tovar about the warnings that should be given when someone proposes to represent himself at a trial versus a guilty plea or some other type of proceeding that is not of the magnitude of a trial.
There seems to be sort of a dollop of this. Your client was being sort of uncooperative and difficult, and therefore, I mean, there's this sense here that how much does the trial court have to put up with before he finally says, all right, you want to represent yourself, go ahead. And I understand you may not agree with that characterization, but I have that question, let's just say hypothetically. Let's say you have a defendant who just keeps stonewalling. We don't want to create error by forcing counsel on him, We don't want to create error by not giving him counsel. What is the trial judge to do?
Well, I think there's a couple of things you can do in a situation like that. And I think, first, I just want to say that I think, yes, Mr. Lopez was giving kind of, as I would put it, crazy talk answers to a lot of the questions the judge was asking. But I think that a lot of this was not due necessarily to purposeful conduct on his part as much as it was to just sort of maladaptive and disoriented behavior caused by these underlying mental problems. But if a defendant is purposefully obstructing the Faretta colloquy, then the court has the option, and this is pointed out in the United States versus Long case that was cited by the government in its recent 28J letter, if the defendant's purposefully obstructing the Faretta colloquy, then the court can deny the motion to proceed pro se and will be upheld.
So the trial judge should then deny the motion and force counsel on the obstructive defendant in that
if, yes. And then there,
that's the default for the trial court is if you're in between a rock and a hard place as the trial judge, choose counsel versus choosing to let him represent himself if the whole matter is becoming difficult to do.
That's what we believe, Your Honor.
Because of obstructive conduct.
Yes, and then you also have the situation, which I think is more akin to what's presented here, where the defendant is not necessarily purposefully obstructing the Faretta colloquy, but nevertheless is just giving non-responsive answers due to mental problems, perhaps, or just misunderstanding, maybe low intellectual functioning. And in that case, Faretta tells us that if you can't be satisfied that the defendant knowingly and intelligently is giving up his right to counsel, you deny it. The default, as Judge Haynes mentioned, is always that there's going to be counsel, and there's got to be this showing of a knowing and intelligent waiver before the court should allow a defendant to proceed pro se.
The government cites a number of cases where other courts have dealt with this question that Judge Haynes raised about an uncooperative defendant, which Faretta was not. And other courts have said that the judges don't have to put up with non-responses, and there was ample evidence to suggest that this man was he might have had his mental problems, but the psychiatrist had also found him uncooperative and manipulative. And so in that case, why shouldn't we follow those other circuits?
Well, I think one good answer is that in Long, which is this court's case, the court said if the defendant is obstructing purposefully the colloquy, then you deny the motion. That's the right thing to do. The defendant has given up his right to proceed pro se. And I think there is, as I pointed out in the reply brief, I think there's a critical difference between this case and the cases cited by the government in that in almost every other case that is cited by the government, the judge actually did go through and do a very careful warning about the dangers and disadvantages. In fact, the case the government relies on most heavily, the Gary case out of the 11th Circuit, there are literally pages and pages of the opinion that are devoted to reciting what the district judge told that defendant about the dangers of going pro se, and we don't have that here.
So you're saying even if the guy is giving sort of nonsensical answers and so forth, the judge still should go through the litany of the dangers, even if he's not getting much back from the defendant, before ruling one way or the other?
Yes, that's exactly what we're saying.
At least say it. Even if the defendant doesn't want to listen to you, at least say it.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in Gary, that was a situation where the judge went through and said it, but you had sort of a recalcitrant defendant who really didn't have mental problems. He was just being stubborn and wouldn't say whether he wanted to go pro se or whether he wanted to proceed with his appointed counsel, but he said, I don't want to do either one. And the judge said, well, by refusing the counsel, I think that you understand the dangers, and so I'm going to make you go pro se, which is a very different situation than here, where Mr. Lopez was never warned about the dangers and disadvantages of proceeding pro se.
And in this hearing, there's no evidence that he was sort of physically obstructive or making it impossible for the judge to go on, you know, like screaming or throwing things or anything like that.
Was there?
In this hearing.
Well, at the beginning of the hearing, there's some evidence that he was restrained and had a mouth guard and so forth, but it seems that, as far as we can tell from the cold record, he had settled down somewhat because the judge made the comment, you're not being as disruptive as I thought you would be. And so And, I mean, the answers are kind of crazy that he gave, but they were respectful because he called the judge sir, and then
They're not really crazy. They're just sort of disjointed, as if two parties are talking past each other. I didn't regard them as crazy.
Well, I'm using the word crazy, perhaps.
I know, because it suits you, but.
Well, no, I'm using it in a colloquial sense. I'm not mean to say he's actually insane, but I think that he is. It was not the most lucid interchange that I've ever seen, and I think that. But the point is, I think that before you pull the trigger and let a defendant go pro se, you have to at least put that information out there about this is not a good idea. You have to, there's a bench book for that very reason.
I was just going to ask that question. I mean, we're not reinventing the wheel here, I take it, because I'm confident there's a Feretta section in the bench book, right?
Absolutely.
And it says in here, okay, here's what you say, da-da-da-da-da-da. And so the defendant, there's no reason why this defendant could not have been subjected to the Feretta portion of the bench book, but he wasn't.
Well, that's true, and I think the judge actually started out along the path of the bench book, but then things just got derailed, and he didn't ask the really important questions dealing with the dangers and disadvantages of self-representation. And I think given that that wasn't put out there, I just don't think this record shows a knowing and intelligent waiver of the right.
I freely agree that this is not a clear-cut, cookie-cutter Feretta situation. On the other hand, the judge didn't come in on a load of wood either. Chances are he's seen hundreds and hundreds of uncooperative defendants, and we ought to at some point trust his intuition as an experienced criminal trial judge, shouldn't we?
With respect, no, Your Honor. I think this court's review is completely de novo about what...
De novo is one thing, but reviewing a cold record is another thing, and we don't know what's going on in the courtroom exactly when all this is happening, but that's just...
That's true, but I think that the case law says you have to look at what is on the written page of the record to see if there's a sufficient waiver, and I grant you that this was a hard case for Judge Crane to handle, but I think he had to make the effort under Feretta at least to put this information out there before he let Mr. Lopez go pro se.
I mean, he's sitting there in a straitjacket. The judge may as well say what he's going to have to say, is what you're arguing. That the defendant is sitting there bound up, gagged, and whatever, and so he's a captive audience for the judge to read the bench book to him.
Yes, and one other point I want to make is there is an overlay here of the recent Supreme Court case in Indiana versus Edwards, which says that it is constitutionally permissible, even where a defendant is competent to stand trial, to find that he is not competent to proceed to a trial and defend himself pro se. And I think that sets up a situation where you actually have two different type of competency proceedings, and I'm not sure that the district court was attuned to the fact that under Indiana versus Edwards, even if he concluded Mr. Lopez was competent to stand trial, he might not necessarily have been.
I wanted to ask about that. I know you're running out of time, but what if, in fact, they'd had a little bit more intelligent discussion in which it was clear that Mr. Lopez has no experience with trials, doesn't really know what he's doing, but that he wants to represent himself. If he's clear on that, but all of his other answers are, I don't know anything about law, I don't understand any of this, I don't know what I'm doing, but I want to represent myself, what's the answer to that?
I think that the balance between Feretta and Indiana versus Edwards is that if a person doesn't have some sort of severe mental illness, then no matter how untrained he or she might be in the law, the person should be allowed to proceed pro se. But I think what Edwards does is it gives trial courts an out that where a person has severe mental illness that, while not rising to the level of incompetency to stand trial, will preclude the defendant from making a cogent defense. I think that Indiana versus Edwards gives the judge the out to say, I'm going to deny your right to proceed pro se, even though you are competent to stand trial with counsel.
So sort of competence versus ability.
Yes, and actually, a couple of the Law Review articles refer to it as competence to stand trial versus competence to defend yourself at trial. And Indiana versus Edwards, as I read it, gives the judge the out in cases of severe mental illness to let a marginally competent person go to trial but force counsel upon him or her. And I'm out of time, so we would just ask that the judgment be reversed. Thank you.
You have rebuttal time, of course. Mr. Turner?
May it please the court, Mr. Crooks. Jim Turner representing the government in the case today, which is styled United States versus Jose Hector Lopez, as he's known in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and Humberto Ramos Valle, as he's known in the state prison system. The court seems that our position is, basically, is whether the district judge below denied him a fair process, due process, when he allowed him to represent himself pro se with standby counsel. And there's been no discussion of standby counsel's role in this post-Edwards. As you review, and to give a little bit of background on this Feretta discussion, in Long, this court pointed out there's two things that have to happen before he can represent himself pro se. He must invoke the right unambiguously. He does so here by saying he wants nothing to do with this attorney. Second, the court must engage him in a Feretta hearing, a so-called Feretta hearing, I think as Judge Smith described it, in U.S. versus Cano, in which he has to admonish him about the dangers of representing himself pro se and the consequences of proceeding pro se and the advantages of proceeding with counsel. Now, the district judge below attempted to do precisely that. In fact, it's somewhat odd that one would look at the situation when the man walks into court, having uttered so much Spanish curse words that the court interpreter couldn't follow them. He had to be covered with a mask so he wouldn't spit on court personnel and his appointed counsel. And he had to be bound so he wouldn't push and shove and whatever else he did. Also, during the course of this proceeding, and I also point out that by the end of this proceeding, he was no longer pro se. By the time he got to sentencing, he had waived the right to proceed pro se by his obstructionist conduct, and he was removed from the courtroom. At that point in time, notwithstanding the fact that the trial judge called standby counsel, counsel became counsel of record.
You're saying at sentencing?
At sentencing. And I would suggest during the course of the trial, he had a fair process because standby counsel was actively engaged in filling in the gaps where the man couldn't address the issues.
Yeah, but we're not supposed to take that into account, are we?
I would think after Edwards, I think it's a way in which the district judge can cap this Feretta aspect of the case. If the judge finds that he cannot represent himself, continue to represent himself along, and I think in Long, it becomes clear that if he acquiesces in pro se's representation, or if he invites pro se representation, it's presumed he's following the standby counsel's representation. He's waived the pro se status, and he's proceeding with counsel. So our suggestion would be that by using standby counsel throughout the course, and the judge protected his interest to due process, ensured he had counsel all the way through. And then counsel did a marvelous job in cross-examining and advancing the defense consistent with McCaskill versus Wiggins. I think he had counsel, he had a fair trial. In fact, the record's going to reflect he got a lot of time off by virtue of counsel's efforts as opposed to his. With respect to this knowledge of this, what he knew and the consequences, it's not put out in the briefs, but there's a terse sentence on page 165 of the record. At the conclusion of the trial, the judge is discussing getting an interview with the probation officer. And he said, we're going to speed this process up. And Mr. Lopez remarks very curtly, it's no problem. I have a lot of time, 20 years. I think the inference from that is he knows precisely what's going on. He's manipulated this system all the way through. Also, I would note at the end of the psychological evaluation report, the concluding remark is he should be encouraged to assist actively in his defense. So the court's trying to ask him to colloquy, to engage in the colloquy required by Feretta. He's getting talked over as he's answering. The answers have come back incongruous with the questions asked. The judge says, and he says that he's somewhat equivocal. If anyone's equivocal on this, it's the district judge. He's saying, I think I'm inclined to let him represent himself. But I want Ms. Medrano, the federal public defender, to stand by his counsel and to assist. He also remarks at the end of the trial that not only does he stand by his counsel, she participated as if she were counsel. So I think what makes this case novel in this sense is that the judge afforded him due process as a result of employing standby counsel in an active role.
That sounds like you're trying to have it both ways. You're trying to say, well, yeah, he got to represent himself, but he also had counsel, so it's no harm, no foul.
In effect, it is true. He's not entitled to hybrid representation, but that's precisely what he had in this instance. He had hybrid representation. It's not a constitutional right he's entitled to, but it's what he had through the trial process. At sentencing, he was represented by counsel. And moreover, the rule is it's an impermissible denial of the proceed pro se is now subject to harmless error. The question here is, having been afforded the right to proceed pro se, were you denied a fair hearing and a fair process because you certainly weren't fully competent to negotiate your way through the process? Moreover, at various points during the proceedings, you indicated that you were so obstructionist and you relied so heavily upon your standby counsel that you were in fact represented by counsel. So we would suggest in terms of harmless error, he was not denied any substantial rights. All of his rights were accorded.
He had the right to be advised of the, you know, sort of bench book Feretta materials. And what would have prevented the district judge from giving him that?
Well, the fact is when he came in, and I think there's a remark in the record where the judge, he was yelled at. So whenever he's trying to ask him the question, he would either get an answer that was a non sequitur or be yelling back.
Cooperative.
And then in the end, and I think that's consistent again with the psychological evaluation report, which the judge knew about before he got in here. The longer this person goes through questioning, the longer Mr. Ramos Valle goes through questioning, the more disruptive it becomes. And that's what the judge is working on. He's working on this personality trait.
Yeah, but he says you've been less uncooperative than I mean, once you shackle the guy and you put the mouth guard on him and all of that, I think he can listen to what is no more than a 5-minute recitation from the bench book.
The problem with it is he wouldn't listen to it because every time the judge would try to ask a question, he was able to speak through this mouth guard. So I'm not familiar with what the nature of the mouth guard was. But he was able to speak through it because if you look, there's a break as the judge is asking the question from the bench book, and he follows the bench book by the letter. He asked this gentleman, do you understand the rules of federal rules of evidence and the federal rules of criminal procedure? And he gets a diatribe about his efforts in TDC representing himself in some administrative hearing. So the judge was trying to go through the entire bench book process, but it was interrupted. It was broken at every turn.
I just don't see that. I mean, I realize a cold record is a cold record, but, you know, the judge is responsible for, even with tough cases and tough defendants, doing what they're supposed to do. So, I mean, I completely appreciate that this was not a happy circumstance for the judge, but you still haven't indicated to me, there's nothing in the record that shows that he became so out of control at this hearing that the judge was not able to finish his recitation of Feretta materials.
Well, again, that's the reason why the judge eventually acceded to his wish to represent himself, because he couldn't get through the questions he wanted to get through with him. He was taking the answers, and he was interpreting his answers and his conduct along with what he knew about this individual from his criminal history and from the psychological evaluation report. And the fact was that he selected to cooperate, he selected to give answers. He wasn't disruptive by virtue of the fact he saw a way to represent himself and to be more active in his defense. That's the inference we draw from the record. And then when it no longer had control of the situation, when he was found guilty, there was no controlling. He came in, the first thing he did down there before sentencing was he flooded his jail cell. Then he came in cursing, which these are put in the record, the words he used there are put in the record, and he was completely disruptive. To the extent where he was initially removed, the court thought about it, you had to bring him back. I've got to give him the admonishment that I'm going to remove you from the courtroom because you're being so disruptive. They brought him back. He's still disruptive, still cursing, still yelling. Made an allusion to his standby counsel, and he's removed again.
I mean, this is during the trial, though. I'm talking about the hearing.
It's at sentencing.
Okay, but I'm talking about the hearing, the Feretta hearing.
What it shows is the total record, the total circumstances of this. As long as he has some control, as long as Lopez Ramos Valle has some control, that he's going to get acquire some secondary gain. In this instance, he's going to have a chance to participate in his defense as counsel pro se with standby counsel, he'll be cooperative. And that's why it's important that we go back to the psychological evaluation report, find out what he was doing there, because he becomes compliant when it's convenient for him. That's what they found out during the course of psychological evaluation. For example, when he used his number two, if it was fecal material, when it came time to stop and get cleaned up, he stopped and got cleaned up. So in the end, we think he was basically, during the course of this Feretta hearing, he was cooperative and not disruptive with the objective of securing his right to proceed pro se. Moreover, we suggest he knew exactly what he was doing when he did this, and we knew he was leaving counsel with eyes open, so he can be more active in his defense. We would suggest that...
What convictions does he have?
I counted 21, Your Honor, 21. One pro se.
We don't know how many of them were trials versus guilty
pleas. I think most of them were guilty pleas. I think the lion's share of them were guilty pleas. I go back, as I look at the pre-sentence report and the summary of his criminal history, I think most of them, because I think what he did was he availed himself of his Mexican citizenship in the state system to shorten those sentences, get kicked out, come back in with a different name, and play the system that way. The judge below was confronted with an individual who basically was manipulating the system. That's what the prosecutor, and the good thing for the prosecutor, we didn't have to sit next to this gentleman. Unfortunately, the federal public defender did. And we have to give standby counsel credit for doing an outstanding job under the circumstances as well. And I think that's the tension between Feretta, Wiggins, and Edwards is in the federal system, because whatever it says, the state system can cap the right to represent yourself pro se if the person is not competent.
What was the maximum sentence to which he was exposed?
20 years. 20 years. It was a big.
So the likelihood is that if we grant relief, I mean, another judge could easily have sentenced him to more than 57 months.
Well, the judge gave him a genuine break because he found the burglary of a habitation was not a 16. The murder, sorry, 16-level increase. He gave him an 8-level increase as opposed to 16. He bumped it up one criminal history category in this instance to account for these 21 convictions and the fact that it understates the seriousness of his criminal conduct.
But I mean, if another judge had looked at this, there are some other judges who would have looked at this and said, you're just a menace to society and you come over here all the time and I'm going to give you 15 years. And
they could have, yes, Your Honor. Under 3553A, they could have made the requisite findings with respect to that. And in one sense, he would be assured of getting his medication that he may need in that instance. If the court has no other questions, I believe I will yield the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Does Feretta require a colloquy in the sense that the defendant is called upon for an interchange, or in this situation where you have someone who's obstreperous, can you simply can the judge simply convey the information that he needs to have and then say at the end, now, do you understand it, and be done with it?
Well, yes, and I think that is the point of the Gary case that the government relied on very heavily in its brief, that in a case where the judge very carefully goes through the dangers and disadvantages but just can't get the defendant to acknowledge his understanding of them or his desire to proceed pro se, then if the judge is satisfied that the defendant does in fact understand, then I think the quote is, a Feretta monologue will suffice.
Okay.
But here we don't even get to that point because the judge didn't even bother to put this information out there about the dangers and disadvantages.
I mean, I have to say, this is a case where I don't understand why this is such a big issue on appeal, because it seems to me that a 57-month sentence for this fellow, in light of his criminal history, is probably way, way too low, according to what the average American and even maybe most of the average border judges would have imposed. You guys should be patting yourselves on the back instead of trying to get a new trial when he's going to be exposed to potentially many years of imprisonment.
I don't think he is, Judge, because this case will go back to Judge Crane, who constitutionally will be prohibited from giving a higher sentence.
No, he's not constitutionally prohibited from anything, and it's not clear to me why it necessarily goes back to Judge Crane. But, I mean, I would think if it's upended because he didn't have counsel, then it would go back into the draw, but I don't.
Well, I think this court's practice has been to send it back to the same judge.
It's not our practice. It's whatever happens on, you know, we just vacate the conviction, then it's up to the district court.
Well, it's what happens on the ground then. But I did want to make three very short points, which are, first, that standby counsel does not render harmless the erroneous granting of a motion to proceed pro se following a defective Faretta colloquy. And this court has repeatedly said that in Davis, in Taylor, in the Balogun case. And the Davis case particularly has a very good discussion of why even hybrid representation is not the counsel guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment. I also want to address Mr. Turner's contention that the judge followed the bench book to the letter. The judge did not follow the bench book to the letter. The judge asked a few questions that were in the bench book, and I'm not going to read them, but I just want to point out the ones that we think are very important that the judge didn't cover in the most current version of the bench book, which is the 2007 version, which are 7, 9, 11, and 12. And those, we think, are the very important advice about dangers and disadvantages that should have been covered but were not. Finally, I just want to stress to the court that this record does not show that Mr. Lopez ever proceeded to a trial with or without counsel, jury, or bench. The record is simply unclear because the record either shows plea of guilty or it has no information about the case. So based on this record, there's no indication that he ever had a jury trial. And for these reasons, we would ask the court to reverse the judgment and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, sir.